From WNYC, this is The Sporkful.
Hey friends, Dan here. Sorry to talk your ear off before the show is even underway, but I just can't contain my excitement. You know, the book, The Sporkful book, it's almost here. It's called Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. And I want to tell you right now about how you can get yourself a signed copy of the book. There are two ways to do it. The first is by getting yourself a book plate. A book plate is basically a sticker that I'll sign and send to you. You can stick it in your book. Now your book's been signed. If you've already bought the book or if you buy it anytime up to October 28th, you're eligible to get one of these free book plates. Just go to sporkful.com and click on book. The second way to get yourself a signed book is to come to one of my book events and have me sign it for you in person. Now in November, I'm going to be going to Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Chicago, San Francisco, and LA. I'll have more details on those dates to come. There's info about it right now at sporkful.com. But let me tell you real quick about the New York events because that's happening in the immediate future. October 16th, Greenpoint, Brooklyn, Word Bookstore. October 19th, Watchung Booksellers, Montclair, New Jersey. October 22nd, Book Court, Cobble Hill, Brooklyn. And October 29th at the Green Space, WNYC's Performance Space, live Sporkful taping with Amy Sedaris and Radiolab's Robert Krulwich. Tickets are on sale now. If you don't score a ticket, it'll be live streamed. For details on all those events and to get your free book plate, go to sporkful.com and click on book. And thanks. Now, here's the show. Recently, BuzzFeed assembled a panel of judges to pick the best bagel in New York.
Thank you so much for doing this. The judges, and I hope all of you have met each other, should take a look at the bagels. I'm going to hand out scoring sheets. You have pens here.
This is the organizer, Josh Robin, laying out the ground rules. Right away, there was dissension in the ranks.
We're going to cut the bagel into pieces, which I know might be sacrilegious in some books.
I'm leaving.
That's one of the judges, former Congressman Anthony Weiner. Yes, that Anthony Weiner. He got into it with BuzzFeed's Emily Fleischaker because he really wanted to inspect each bagel whole. He did not think they should be cut in advance.
That's offensive to my sensibility. You don't eat a bagel in little bits. This isn't a cocktail party.
Do you slice it in half?
Whoa. You don't ask a judge how I do my thing. I mean, do you ask Van Gogh how he does an orchestra? No. So, I mean...
Sounds to me like you're coming in with a lot of preconceived ideas about what you want these
bagels
to taste like.
If you did not want judgment, you called the wrong judge.
People have strong opinions about bagels. And in fairness, the congressman wasn't just grandstanding. He worked at a bagel shop in Brooklyn long before he got into politics. And he laid out some pretty good reasons for wanting to see the bagels whole.
If you haven't done the water bath sufficiently right, then the crust doesn't come out just right. So a lot of it is aesthetics. Like it doesn't have a hole or it's too puffy or... I mean, if at the very least your bagel is not bagel-shaped, you're probably off to a rocky start.
Today on The Sporkful, we're talking bagels. On the media's Brooke Gladstone will rage against the dying of the light of the classic bagel. Plus, when is it appropriate to toast a bagel? I'll argue that question with Marketplace's Mark Garrison. And a bagel historian joins me for a new segment we call Nerding Out. Stay with us. From WNYC, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman, and today we're talking bagels from every angle. But before we get into this show's bready interior, we must first pierce its crust. And that means we need some information. So I'm pleased to introduce a new semi-regular feature here on The Sporkful that we call Nerding Out. That's a sound effect that I thought we should have for Nerding Out. I didn't actually get a real sound effect yet. Joining me now from Cambridge, Mass. To nerd out on bagels is Maria Balinska. She's a bagel historian and author of The Bagel, The Surprising History of a Modest Bread. Hi, Maria.
Hi.
Let's begin at the beginning. How exactly do you make a bagel?
The very first step is that you need a kind of flour that's different from your regular bread flour. A bagel has a high gluten flour, and of course the gluten is a protein, but you can think of it the way the Chinese describe it, which is the muscle in the bread. So you start out with your high gluten flour, and then your dough is going to have less water than your usual bread. that gives the dough a very, you know, it makes it very stiff. And if you read some of the old accounts, and in fact, I spoke to some of these bakers who in the 50s and 60s would literally use their feet to knead the dough because it was just impossible to do it by hand. So you've got your flour, you've got your dough.
You got your feet.
Well, the next step, of course, is to actually roll the bagels and make them, to shape them.
So let's move on to boiling and then baking.
But the one part of the process that most bakeries now omit is what is called retardation. It's the dough, once it's in the rings, it's allowed to rise in a cool place. And what that does is it slows down the yeast because it's cool, but it allows lactic acid to form, and it gives it that slightly acid bite to the dough. But that takes, you know, 14 hours. So that's not necessarily the most efficient way of making bagels. So once you have the rings, they've been either retarded or they've risen a bit, then we have boiling, which, of course, is an extremely important part of the process. And with boiling, it expands the interior, right, of the dough, but it keeps the shape because you've got the pressure of the water on the ring. So in other words, if you put that ring straight into the oven, it would bloat. But you're cooking it while sort of having that water pressure keep it a certain size. And at the same time, the boiling gelatinizes the starch on the crust, which makes it nice and shiny. But the critical thing is, you know, you can't boil it too much and you can't boil it too little. If it's been boiled too little, so that would be more akin to some of the shortcuts that are sometimes taken in big factories, sort of akin to quick steam, then you're not going to have the same density. It's more like a bread roll then.
One of the things that we hear a lot when we talk about bagels in the New York area, and this is a national, international show, and we're not especially New York centric, but we can't talk about bagels and not talk about New York. I do happen to be one of the people who thinks that the bagels in New York tend to be better than the bagels you get in most other places. And the theory we hear time and time again is it's the water. You boil those bagels in the water, New York water, something special about it makes the bagels great. You've looked into this in great detail for your book and in your research and your work as a bagel historian. What have you found?
Well, obviously, this was at the top of my mind, particularly given all the New Yorkers who continually told me that the water is what makes the difference. Interestingly, when I put that to a bread scientist in Kansas, he was pretty dismissive of that theory. From what I understand, however, New York water is a soft water. So it has low concentrations of calcium and magnesium. Whereas if you go to Chicago, Los Angeles, it's much harder water. A softer water will make the dough a little less tough. So it could have an impact.
If it's not the water in New York, then you feel like it's mostly just the fact that traditional methods are more often employed in New York, a lot of Jewish immigrants in New York. Is that the next best theory, or is there some other possibility that I'm missing?
Well, I think there's no question that New York was the center for bagel baking for most of the 20th century. There was a concentration of bakeries and people were demanding of their bagels.
Final question, Maria. Why do bagels have holes?
Now that's a good question. there are three ways of looking at that question. So one is it gives you the maximum crust. Right? In terms of just the surface area.
That's right. More surface area in relation to volume. That's a common topic here on the Sporkful. You're in friendly territory here, Maria. Go on.
Excellent. And also, you'd never be able to have just a roll without a hole boiled and baked. I mean, you'd not be able to bite through it. It would just be impossible. So that's one thing. A second thing that was a practical consideration was that bagels were traditionally carried on ropes and sticks by peddlers. So those are the sort of down-to-earth considerations. But, of course, the sort of more mystical thing is that, you know, once you've finished eating around the ring, which, after all, a ring is a symbol of eternity, right, because it has no beginning, it has no end, And once you've finished eating that ring, you're left with the hole, which of course is infinity, and therefore you're, you know, in your bagel eating experience, you actually are having a spiritual experience at the same time, which, you know, is entirely fitting for such a fantastic bread, which, if you think about it, is a form of halo.
A bagel halo, bagels continuing for eternity, and the spiritual experience of eating a bagel. Maria Belinska, bagel historian and author of The Bagel, The Surprising History of a Modest Bread. Thanks for nerding out with us.
It was my pleasure. I can nerd out anytime.
Here on The Sporkful, we don't quarrel over issues of personal preference. As the Latin maxim goes, de gustibus non est disputandum. In matters of taste, there can be no dispute. On The Sporkful, we deal in objective truth. Now, at most places, when you get a bagel, they ask you if you want it toasted. Harmless enough question, right? Wrong. This is a huge issue, and it's not just a matter of taste. I debated bagel toasting with my friend Mark Garrison from Marketplace. I began by asking him where he stands. To toast or not to toast?
I respect an untoasted bagel, and I like to, sometimes even without even slicing it, just to like have like, especially if it's very fresh, to get the bagel out of the bag and just like eat it on the go as a snack. Like if I'm walking around, like I don't like to deal with cream cheese and things like that. But if I'm going to split it and there's going to be any butter, any cream cheese, anything other than just me biting into it, I want it to be toasted because I like that texture. I like to be able to have like a kind of a firm texture on the outside and then the chewy, yummy bagelness on the inside once I'm chewing through the toasted exterior.
I agree that the toasted bagel has its place, but its place is 1 to 2 days after that bagel has been birthed. Okay? Toasting a bagel is what you do with a bagel that's not that good. If you're stuck and you need a bagel, you're going to go to Dunkin' Donuts and get a bagel. You know, or any bagel chain around the country that has mediocre bagels, fine, toast it, because it's the great equalizer.
It can mostly redeem. I mean, same thing with bread. Like, you know, when you choose the bread to toast, you're going to choose the least fresh bread for toasting. But I will say that I don't think the bagel, if we're talking about actually putting cream cheese onto a bagel, I don't like, even if it's a great fresh bagel, I totally respect that and know that it can be good on its own without toasting. But when you add cream cheese to it, it's just kind of like, you know, cream cheese texture over chewy bagel texture. And there's not any of that. There's a little bit of firmness in the bagel, but there's not like that little bit of crisp to set off that cream cheese. So I think it becomes an issue then.
Let's assume you have a fresh bagel, a high quality fresh
Sure.
bagel. When you're making a bagel with cream cheese with that bagel, the bagel is the star.
The bagel is the star, but if we're going to do an untoasted bagel and the bagel is going to be the star, I think you have to treat it more as like kind of a one-man show rather than an ensemble cast.
You're talking eating, you'll eat the bagel plain?
Yeah.
I mean, I'll do that sometimes, yeah. but a fresh bagel with cream cheese is a great thing. When you toast a fresh bagel, you are killing it. You are stabbing a knife through its essence because, you know.
Well, no, the essence, well, all you're doing is you're changing the exterior, but the essence on the inside is still.
You are removing moisture. A bagel is cooked partially in water. What makes any kind of bread fresh is moisture. And as bread goes stale, it is drying out slowly over time.
I mean,
when you toast it, you are removing the moisture.
No, you're applying dry heat, but again, like it's not penetrating all the way through the bagel.
I'm just surprised because you are someone who is always trying to divine the intention of foods. And I don't know why you would want to hasten a bagel's death. You are moving a bagel closer to stale when you take a fresh bagel and toast it.
Because again, we're talking about like the bagel. It's not as much like defining the essence, but thinking about the acting abilities of the bagel, because we're talking about how you're casting this bagel. So again, one bagel show, fresh bagel, untoasted, unadorned, not even sliced, just bite into it. It's so great. You can just walk out of the bagel store and you're eating this already because it smells great and it's awesome. That's the one bagel show. But again, the bagel as an expert actor, excellent performer, when cast in an ensemble cast, understands that its performance must change. And that's what the toasting does.
But it's the star. First, you decide you're going to have a bagel. Then you decide what you're going to put on it. When you're casting a film, once you get Brad Pitt in the movie, anyone else who wants to be in the movie has to get along with Brad Pitt.
That's Mark Garrison from Marketplace.
Coming up, we'll cover the growing crisis of bagelflation. If a bagel has inflated to the point that it has no hole, is it still a bagel? I'll ask On the Media's Brooke Gladstone. Plus, I'll share a secret for bringing stale bagels back from the dead. And it doesn't involve toasting. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC. I'm Dan Pashman. In recent years, a confluence of trends has created controversy in the bagel community. Bagels are getting bigger, losing crustiness, and puffing up to the point that their trademark holes are closing.
Ugh, it's a shanda.
I know. The line that separates bagels from rolls is blurring. Will purebred bagels be mongrelized to the point of extinction?
It's happened already, my friend.
Or am I just an old crank standing in the way of progress?
No, a purist,
okay.
Not a crank.
All right. Here to discuss this question and many more is the esteemed co-host and managing editor of WNYC's On the Media, Brooke Gladstone. Hey, Brooke.
Hi, Dan.
So, as I suggested, we meet here at a moment of great crisis.
Indeed.
Do you share my concern?
Oh, profoundly.
Go on.
Profoundly. I mean, what's happened to the bagel of not just my childhood, but the bagel that really stands for a generation of immigrant New Yorkers, is just a terrible, terrible shame. I mean, having something called a bagel, which is really just a Kaiser roll with a gloss, it's a betrayal.
I think that's right. Can you pinpoint the moment when you started to notice that this was happening?
Shockingly, it was when I moved to New York City and found that H&H had crossed over to the dark side.
How so?
It had become the puff, the missing hole, the bread item that gave no resistance to your teeth. And basically, there was no distinction between what was on the outside and what was on the inside.
H&H, for those who don't know, was for a long time one of the top bagel places in New York City. So bagels are getting bigger. They're not as crusty as they used to be. It's an existential issue. Let's get right to the heart of the matter, Brooke. If it doesn't have a hole in the middle, is it still a bagel?
It is not the classic bagel. It isn't so much the presence of the hole. It's what the disappearing hole represents or portends. Because if the hole disappears because of huge puff, then it's a very bad sign. But if the person making the bagel has simply twisted it in such a way that the two edges of the nice, dense, crusty bagel happen to be close together, and so the hole is really small or hardly even there, that's not a problem for me.
That's just the natural variation in handmade bagels.
Exactly. I mean, I have to say that there are other things that I find mildly disturbing about the current bagel culture. Blueberries and cinnamon. I mean, that's what I call an ethical culture bagel, not a New York bagel. It's a secular humanist bagel. I guess they have their place, but this march towards blandness, to approachability. I mean, the same thing happened in a related subject to lox. When can you get belly lox today? When I was a kid living on Long Island, I would tear the intensely salty belly lox in tiny little pieces and spread it all around my bagel. Now you can slap on a piece of Nova, you know, as thick as a book, and you're still not going to taste anything.
It is very bland and sliced too thickly. You're absolutely right. And people who don't know, belly lox is like a really old school New York Jewish type of lox that is extremely salty.
Very salty. You really had to be careful. But when you put it on the bagel, the whole thing snapped into focus. And you had an experience, and it was an intense one. But it seems all of our food is marching towards blandness. All the ethnicity of ethnic food seems to be draining away in our great melting pot.
But rather than just railing against these trends that you and I agree, Brooke, are problematic, let's first talk about the ideal bagel, the platonic ideal.
You described it in your intro when you talked about what was going wrong, you know, the lack of resistance in a shiny crust. the density inside the bagel, which you sort of sink into. You just don't sort of bite through it and then there's like nothing there but air. This is not an air-based food. Every bagel probably contains the same calories of four pieces of bread when they're made right. Not two, but four.
Smushed into something that takes up the same amount of space.
That's right.
Right, I see. Well, that brings me to something I wanted to cover with you, which is when you have a bagel that's overpuffed, outsized, one of these problematic bagels we've been discussing, what are some of the things that you can do? Because it throws off ratios. If you're putting in cream cheese, lox, or whatever you're putting in there, it's very tough to get good ratios when you got a bagel that's 4 inches tall.
I take the croissant. I will not sully my insides with empty calories. You might as well eat a roll of toilet paper.
So you're just saying if it's a bad bagel, you don't want it no matter what?
I mean, look, if you're not going to have the classic bagel where you get the intense experience in exchange for what is fundamentally an unhealthy activity, why would I indulge in the unhealthy activity when I will get none of the sensual pleasure from it?
One more thing I want to throw at you with regard to altering the size of a bagel to bring its ratios better in line for sandwichization is something I call bagel trifurcation.
Mm-hmm.
Slicing the bagel horizontally in thirds instead of in half and removing that middle disc, using it sort of like as a bagel chip, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
I like that better than scooping, because when you scoop, now you kind of only have crust. You don't have it. You lose most of the dense interior.
Mm-hmm.
With bagel trifurcation, you preserve some dense interior along with the crust while still reducing the overall height of the bagel.
Yes, I see the logic in that. I do want to make a point about something, though.
Please.
Which is that if I'm going to go outside of the realm of classic bagel, I'll go Canadian, not puffy. Go north of the border. They have an entirely different style of bagel. It is sweeter, although it is still dense, and it's crusty. And they use more sesame seeds than we do, and they can be darker. They are delicious, and they do take cream cheese and lox and the other accoutrement very well.
So you would rather go to a whole other country than to have a poor imitation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, who wouldn't?
Right. That's fair. I'm with you on that. What's your favorite bagel? What's your favorite variety?
Okay, now here I probably will, you know, there are some purists who don't like anything on a bagel, but I'm a kind of an everything gal.
Interesting.
I love everythings.
Isn't everything the very definition of the secular humanist bagel?
No, because an everything bagel has everything that you get individually on classic bagels. You get your sesame, you get your poppy, you get a little garlic, maybe a little onion, maybe a little salt.
When you buy everything bagels at the bagel shop, if you're also buying other varieties of bagel, do you sequester the everything bagels in a separate bag?
Oh, never, never.
Really?
I like commingling.
What?
So I'll put the everything bagel in, because the everything bagel, I will often get sesame bagels, poppy bagels, a couple of plain, maybe a garlic or a salt, and some everything bagels. They, you know, once you take them apart, they're all redolent with wonderfulness.
Once those bagels end up in a bag with even one everything bagel, they are all corrupted. You basically have a bag full of everything bagels.
Oh, come on. You don't get that stuff in your mouth, just a little in your nose.
As we know, so much of taste comes from scent. But you don't have that issue? I mean, maybe you don't, because you're one of these people who likes everything bagels, so you don't mind if all bagels taste like everything bagels.
You're right. I've just revealed myself as horrendously self-centered. And yet no one has ever complained. Maybe they're just so grateful to be getting such a good bagel that they're willing to put up with my...
The tyranny of everything bagels.
That's right. Not only that, I'll usually throw in a couple of Bialys.
Oh, my God. Why don't you just get some, like, pesticide and spray it all over the bagel?
Pesticide?
I mean, it's just...
I guess you're one of those people who just doesn't believe garlic improves everything.
I believe that fresh garlic improves everything. With that dried garlic that they put on bagels, like, out of the can, it's just, like...
How do you know they're out of the can?
You can just tell by looking at it. And the way it smells, it doesn't smell like fresh garlic. It smells that
so
kind of
you're
bitterness.
You're a plain bagel guy, aren't
you?
I'm
a sesame.
You're a sesame. My husband's a poppy. Yeah, a sesame.
And your husband doesn't get upset when you hand him a poppy bagel that smells like an everything bagel?
Oh, no. Not in the least. Then again, we have been together for more than 30 years, so I'm sure he has bigger fish to fry.
Maybe he actually likes everything bagels and doesn't even realize it. I think that it should be a regular practice at all bagel shops to sequester everything bagels. You shouldn't have. It shouldn't be a special request.
Uh-huh.
Cross-contamination is a crucial issue with everything bagels or any garlic onion bagels.
I can see you feel strongly about this.
I do. This is a big issue for me, Brooke.
And we were getting along so well.
You talked earlier about taking belly lox, which is the very salty lox, shredding it into very small pieces, sprinkling it around the bagel, and then spreading cream cheese on the bagel, which really, in a way, is kind of a very clever, artisanal method of making lox spread. How do you feel about lox spread?
I think there is a place for lox spread, but sometimes it's made really well with nice chunks of lox in it, and sometimes it's sort of this overall carroty colored orange, at which point it doesn't taste like anything resembling lox. I have this sort of Kraft cheesy thing when I look at it, and I don't go near it. So you have to be really careful with your lox spread.
I'm pretty much universally opposed to lox spread. I feel like it's always going to be a poor substitute for a bagel with lox. It's really like, it's for people who want a bagel with lox but don't want to spend the money on lox.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Like, I'd rather have lox half as often and save the money up to get the real deal half as often than to have a lox spread every time.
On this, I will agree. Great. I never buy lox spread, but I don't oppose it on principle unless it's orange.
Okay. I'm with you on that, yeah. You need to be able to see pieces of lox in it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have ways to bring bagels back to life? Do you use the classic way?
I do, but I want to hear what's the classic way.
You sprinkle it with water, put it in a hot oven, and it comes out almost as if it were new.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do more than sprinkle it. I run it under hot water for 20 or 30 seconds.
Wow.
Then
and it doesn't get all soggy?
No, they put it in the oven for 5 minutes at 350. And yeah, it's amazing.
I've always been careful to just, what I'll do is I'll, you know, wet my hands and just sort of glide it over the edge and then stick it in.
Oh,
but a bagel that is really rock hard, I can't bring back. Maybe I could if I let it go for a while.
That's right. All right. Well, Brooke Gladstone, co-host and managing editor of WNYC, is on the media. I should tell everyone, if you don't listen to On the Media already, you really need to make it a part of your life. I love what you guys do on the media. I feel like you have managed to get this extraordinary combination of you and your co-host, Bob Garfield, bring personality and perspectives and points of view to the show, which makes it so much more compelling than a sort of typical blah news show. But you still always manage to give all sides a fair hearing and to uphold the highest tenets of great journalism. And I know what a difficult tightrope that is to walk to bring all those components together. And you guys just do it amazingly well every week. So,
aw, shucks, Dan.
On the media, check it out. Brooke, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that just about does it for this week, friends. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. Remember that I want to sign your copy of the Sporkful book. There's two ways to do it. You can get the free book plate. I'll sign it and send it to you. Or you can come to one of my events around the New York area or across the country. For details on the book plates and the events, go to sporkful.com and click on book. Please make sure you subscribe to this podcast in iTunes. That way you can make sure you always get it. To do that, go to itunes.com/sporkful. This show is a production of WNYC and The Sporkful. It's produced by Kristen Meinzer, who, by the way, has her own excellent podcast. It's called Movie Date Podcast. And I'm not just saying it's excellent because I was on it last week. It's excellent even when I'm not on it. Check it out at moviedatepodcast.org. We get web help from Talia Ralph and Alight Trong. Special thanks to Chris Bannon. I'll be back in just 1 week with a special all-star book release spectacular edition of The Sporkful with Rachel Maddow, Radiolab's Robert Krulwich, and Slate's Julia Turner. It's going to be a good one. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.